Since the Janet Jackson Super Bowl flap, it seems like everybody is up in arms about indecency on broadcast TV and radio. Clear Channel dropped the Howard Stern Show from its stations, and CBS just announced that they would be putting next month's NCAA Final Four basketball tournament on a 10-second delay. As our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, this is all part of a conversation that goes back to Shakespeare's time.
A lot of people were dismayed when the FCC refused to sanction NBC last year after Bono uttered the F-word on the Golden Globe broadcast, saying, "This is really, really effing brilliant." But as the agency noted, their guidelines limit indecency to descriptions or depictions of sexual or excretory organs or activities. Whereas Bono merely used the word as an adjective or expletive to emphasize an exclamation, as the agency put it. Actually, some people suggested that the F word is really an adverb when it modifies the adjective brilliant, but I could go either way on that one. I mean, if it were really an adverb, wouldn't it end in L-Y? In the wake of the flap over Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction at the Super Bowl, FCC Commissioner Michael Powell announced that he would be reconsidering the Bono ruling. And a California Republican congressman named Doug Ose recently introduced the Clean Airwaves Act to close what he described as a loophole in the legal definition of indecency. The act explicitly lists 7 words that will qualify a broadcast as indecent, however they're used, including verb, adjective, gerund, participle, and infinitive forms. Ose's bill is easy picking for satirists, of course. It's a law that would make it a punishable offense to read its own text over the airwaves. But you have to admit that the FCC was being a little obtuse when it held that Bono's remark wasn't profane. Who's kidding whom here? Does anybody really think that the F-word is less of a profanity when it's an intensifier modifying brilliant than when it's describing sexual activity? The fact is that profanity isn't a question of subject matter. It works by a kind of contagious magic. The reference pollutes the word, and then the word profanes everything else it comes in contact with, even if it has nothing to do with the original meaning. That's a principle that children already know when they take a naughty pleasure in pronouncing the word shampoo. And that's why our sense of propriety can be satisfied by the simple expedient of bleeping out part of the word or substituting an asterisk for its vowel. Swear words are like magic spells. They lose their power if every syllable isn't enunciated just so. In fact, profanity is our first lesson in linguistic transgression, even before we understand what it means to lie. That's why it's always a little weird to hear foreigners cursing in English, even if they speak the language fluently. You know that nobody ever washed their mouth with soap for saying them. So the prudes and the profaners are locked into an internal codependence. Swearing has always flourished most luxuriantly in ages when it could count on offending middle-class delicacy. In Henry IV, Part 1, Hotspur rebukes his wife for using the dainty shopkeeper's oath in sooth. "Swear me, Kate, like a lady as thou art, a good mouth-filling oath." And say what you will about Ose's bill, at least he and his colleagues are doing their part to keep some of the magic of swearing alive. When you turn to one of the subscription channels and hear a profanity-laced monologue by Margaret Cho, Bill Maher, or Chris Rock, half the pleasure comes from imagining how apoplectic some people would get if they heard that language on NBC or CBS. It gives you the sense you're getting something for your $59 a month. And we all have a stake in keeping those inhibitions alive. Every time we tell our children not to use the F word, we're making a little investment in the future health of profanity. If we ever reach the point where every local TV weatherman is using the word, it won't mean any more for us than darn does. Still, while the family values crowd have already had their effects on programming, they're ultimately fighting a losing battle. The problem isn't that they're being obvious hypocrites. Of course they are, but then where would profanity be without hypocrisy? What does a swear word come down to in the end, if not something you can say in private but not in public? But the boundaries have gotten pretty arbitrary nowadays. Time was that the disapproval of public profanity reflected a basic line of demarcation in American life between the parlor and the rooms in the back of the house. Now it's just a tick mark on the double digits of the dial. Not much of a frontier, particularly when 90% of Americans pay for some form of subscription TV. And it's hard to imagine what Henry James would have made of a world where you can use the F word in the New Yorker, but not the New York Times. Not that the Times is wrong to abjure profanity. It's of a piece with the Edwardian habit of referring to everybody as Mr., even Sting and Moby. But whom exactly are we pretending to protect from what? And when you listen to the run of broadcast fare, it's clear these linguistic scruples don't have much to do with stemming the tide of vulgarity and coarseness. Nowadays, questions of public morality usually come down to purely symbolic gestures. The lesson of the Super Bowl brouhaha was that images of crotch-biting dogs and farting horses are less of a threat to the moral health of the Republic than a glimpse of nipple jewelry. We've gotten to the point where somebody can offer a clean airwaves act that consists of a single paragraph containing a list of 7 words. Actually, that's the one thing that makes me wonder if we've let things go too far. Just 7 words, Falstaff wouldn't have known where to start.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of the forthcoming book, Going Nuclear.